Today, the story of the House of Saud and Islamic jihadists.
The Taliban with oil wells, the way a Bloomberg article today describes the sudden and extraordinary wealth and power of the so-called Islamic State, which now controls large swathes of Syria and Iraq.
More than a million people have been driven from their homes and many have been slaughtered in brutal fashion by Islamic State militants. Tony Abbott says Australia can't stand by and watch.
Madam Speaker, I refuse to call this hideous movement Islamic State, because it's not a state, it's a death cult.
The world's attention is currently firmly fixed on the expansion of ISIS in Iraq and Syria. We've watched in horror as ISIS beheaded journalists and aid workers and terrorised Shiites and non-Muslims alike. But groups like ISIS don't appear out of nowhere. They arise in a political and historic context. ISIS emerged from within the opposition to the Assad regime in Syria, and at a moment when Iran and Saudi Arabia are vying for political influence in the region. Hello, this is Rear Vision on RN and via the web. Today we're going to take a look at the role Saudi Arabia has played in the emergence of Islamic jihadists. Oil-rich Saudi Arabia is one of the last theocratic monarchies left on the planet. Many Saudis are known to have supported jihadist movements in Afghanistan, North Africa and Syria. Most of the terrorists involved in September 11 were Saudi nationals. Despite this, Saudi Arabia is the United States' most dependable ally in the Middle East. The story of Saudi Arabia and its relationship with Islamic extremists is complex and goes back to the turn of the last century when modern Saudi Arabia was formed. Toby Jones is Associate Professor in the Department of History, Rutgers University, and the author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia.
Well, Saudi Arabia's modern history starts in 1902 when what is today the ruling family, the Al Saud, who were living in exile at the time in modern-day Kuwait, mounted a raiding party out of the northern Persian Gulf into Riyadh and sacked a rival governor, toppled him from power, and established a foothold. With a foothold established in 1902, they were able to consolidate power in the central peninsula. They expanded out very slowly. They mounted a raiding party, a military campaign. I call it a war of imperial expansion into the east in 1913. The eastern province, which, as I mentioned, is home today to all of Saudi Arabia's oil. And the era before oil was important because it was home to the most plentiful water resources in the region. And the Saudis aspired to control both that, but also to be tapped in or to be connected to the trading networks that were in which those regions were integrated. In the late 1920s, their aspirations turned westward and they mounted a second round of imperial wars in which they conquered Mecca and Medina and Jeddah. Beginning in the 1930s, they declared the modern kingdom of Saudi Arabia. They had the support of, and this happened in 1932, they enjoyed the support of the British. And then shortly after that, an American oil company swooped in 1933, signed themselves up to an oil concession, and began prospecting for oil, which they discovered in commercial quantities at the end of the 1930s. By that point, the Saudis were able to enjoy some economic independence, largely thanks to American corporate largesse. And from there, it's a matter of luck. The Al Saud over the second half of the 20th century were quite fortunate that they happened to be home or privy to control over the largest oil reserves on the planet.
So explain the connection between the Saudi royal family and the Wahhabi religious tradition.
The relationship between a group of scholars who embrace a particular form of Islamic orthodoxy and members of the Saudi family, the Al Saud, have had a partnership that dates back to the late 18th century. Wahhabism, as we tend to think about it historically, emerged as a revival movement, a kind of reformist movement that grew out of the disillusion that one particular religious scholar, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, shared in the late 18th century, frustrated about what he considered to be decay in the Islamic community and the Muslim world, and articulated for a kind of austerity movement and tied himself politically to the Al Saud. Now, Ibn Abdul Wahhab was important because he argued for a kind of offensive military campaign that was ostensibly about cleansing the Muslim community and stripping it of religious excess, rituals, and beliefs that had accumulated over time and that he considered had derivated from the Word of God. For their part, the Al Saud saw this as an instrument of convenience, a kind of ideology or religious force that they could use to claim their political legitimacy, but that also sanctioned both authoritarianism and violence in the name of religion. And that has been a partnership that's endured usefully and fruitfully for both the Wahhabi scholarly community as well as the Al Saud ever since. So it's over 200 years old and has managed to survive where the Ottoman Empire as well as European colonialism failed.
Madawi al-Rashid, visiting professor at the London School of Economics and the author of A History of Saudi Arabia, argues that the Saudi royal family reinvented the Wahhabi tradition to justify their own claim for power and expansion.
In other Arab countries, there was a nationalist discourse about the nation and how the nation should become sovereign and detach itself from any foreign protection. Now, in Saudi Arabia, the Saudi area that became the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia didn't really have that nationalist discourse or nationalist sentiments. And there were no historical precedents whereby the whole region was governed as one entity. And therefore, the Al Saud reinvented the 18th century Wahhabi movement, which is a puritanical movement initially aiming to return people to the right path of Islam. And this involved religious wars against those who refused the political leadership or rejected the political leadership of the Al Saud. But they were depicted as people whose Islam wasn't the right Islam, and therefore they had to succumb to the authority of the Al Saud. And the Al Saud themselves used the Wahhabi tradition, which started in the 18th century and had a troubled history in the region. At the same time, they were able to bring this vast territory together and subject the people under the pretext of Islamizing them, which was a violent episode in the 20th century. It lasted for more than 25 years, at the end of which the Al Saud declared themselves as the rulers, and they had to continue this alliance with the Wahhabi clerics who supported the regime and also were given certain priorities in running the social and religious affairs of the country. Until the present day, this alliance between the Al Saud and the Wahhabi clerics continue, and it is extremely important because the Wahhabis provided the religious discourse to submit the population to political authority, to allow them to become obedient to the political authority. And from early on, they outlawed any kind of political mobilization, demonstrations, strikes, etc., and insisted that a good Muslim, such as the one who follows their way of life, should have total obedience to rulers and should not undermine peace and security in the country. And therefore, this alliance became extremely important to maintain the Al Saud rule.
The other thing that became important was the incredible growth in oil revenues.
Oil began to flow in commercially viable, profitable amounts in the 1950s and 1960s. Saudi Arabia began to enjoy a significant influx of oil revenues by the end of the 1960s. By 1971 or 1972, we're talking about average annual incomes, probably somewhere on the order of $2 to $3 billion a year in oil revenues. But the Saudi Arabia that we know today, a place that generates wealth that's almost difficult to imagine, hundreds of billions of dollars a year in revenue, really begins in the middle of the 1970s, following the oil crisis of 1973, 1974, the October War between Egypt and Israel in 1973, the embargo that the Saudis and OPEC attempted to impose on the United States and the Netherlands in 1973 and into 1974. The net effect of all of this was that Arab oil-producing states nationalized their oil industries. They took it away from the Western corporations, began controlling production, and raised tax rates on oil that resulted in probably the largest transfer of wealth in human history. So that by the end of the 1970s, we're talking about an amount of oil revenue and oil wealth that's being generated that is several orders of magnitude greater than it had ever been before. So for 1972 and 1973, the Saudis were making $2 to $3 billion a year in oil revenue. By the end of the decade, they're making somewhere between $100 and $110 billion a year in revenue. And today we're looking at numbers that are 2 to 3 times that on average.
Oil was, in a way, a mixed blessing. It allowed the state to spend lavishly on the infrastructure of the country, but at the same time, it brought corruption and inequality. Today, the Al Saud control this oil, and there is lack of transparency, and also there's a high level of corruption by international standards. But at the same time, it allowed a situation where we could think of unequal development. So the big cities are developed with infrastructures, but at the same time, there were groups that were excluded. These groups are not only the Shia in the eastern province, who actually live almost above the oil fields, but also other remote regions, for example, the northern part of Saudi Arabia and the southwest on the border with Yemen. These regions remain underdeveloped, and most recently there were reports that there is a high level of poverty. And this simply comes with the unequal distribution of wealth, the lack of transparency. And remember, Saudi Arabia does not have any kind of representative institutions. The country is run as an absolute monarchy with groups, notables allied to the regime who get quite a lot of benefits. There is a growing private sector, but in order to operate in Saudi Arabia, you need to be well connected with the ruling family. And therefore, this kind of system excludes quite a lot of people in the country who will find it difficult. One of the main problems that Saudi Arabia is facing now is unemployment among its youth population, simply because the oil industry and the oil economy failed to produce jobs. It employs quite a lot of people, but then the service economy around oil has not been able to create the jobs for the population whose size is increasing.
It's been this oil wealth, according to Patrick Coburn, author of The Jihadist Returns, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising, that has led to the dominance of Wahhabi Islam across the Muslim world.
I think one of the most important trends in the Muslim world, perhaps in the world as a whole over the last 50 years, has the way in which Wahhabism has influenced and to some extent taken over mainstream Sunni Islam. The 1.4, 1.5 billion Sunni Muslims in the world. Why has it become so influential? Well, mainly Saudi money. If you want to build a mosque in Bangladesh or some other poor country, you need $20,000. The only place you can get it easily is from Saudi Arabia or some Saudi charity. So this has been true across the Muslim world for a long time now, and it's given Wahhabism enormous influence. It's also meant that relations between Sunni and Shia have got much worse, because Wahhabism regards Shia as basically being non-Muslims. This wasn't true of Sunni Islam before.
You're with Rear Vision on RN and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're tracing the historical relationship between Saudi Arabia and the growth of Islamic extremists.
Basically, the Saudi state itself was founded on a radical element because it launched wars to Islamize people. So they used Islam as a pretext for a political project. And therefore, from the 1920s onward, the project was based on this kind of radical Islam that aims to exclude every other interpretation of Islam, and it wants to enforce a strict puritanical interpretation. And therefore, it is very difficult to dissociate the radical interpretations from the Saudi state.
A general has crossed the Afghan border towards home in the final act of the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan. The 9-year Soviet campaign against Afghan Muslim guerrillas was costly both in the number of lives lost and in Soviet prestige.
Basically, the Saudi state used that radical element in, for example, the Cold War, which seemed to have suited Western powers. And here I'm referring to Afghanistan in the 1980s, where Saudi money, with the approval of the U.S. and the help of the U.S. and other Western powers, such as Britain, tried to use that religious sort of fanaticism in order to expel the Soviets from Afghanistan, and it did work. However, whatever you export is bound to come back. So in the 90s, we begin to see that this radical tradition gathered momentum and became strong, and it became a problem inside Saudi Arabia itself that culminated in the terrorism episode between 2003 and 2008. And the Saudis have always relied on this kind of traditional radical Islam, but they wanted to channel its sort of radicalism abroad. And we see the same thing happening now. And therefore, this traditional radical trend is always there. But the only problem in 9/11 was that it collided with the allies of the Saudis.
Freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward.
The once towering World Trade Center in New York's financial district is no more. It took two direct hits when two hijacked passenger aircraft were flown into its two towers.
A fleet of ambulances screamed down Riyadh city streets to three separate locations in order to ferry the wounded to emergency hospital units. Saudi TV shows shattered houses and apartment blocks cluttered by smoke, as well as twisted and burnt-out cars in the streets. Helicopters swoop overhead.
But first to the bomb attacks in Saudi Arabia. According to Reuters news agency, at least 10 people have lost their lives. The Saudi government says that suicide bombers driving vehicles stuffed with high explosives were behind three blasts. Foreign Affairs Minister Alexander Downer says the terrorist network Al-Qaeda is likely to have been responsible for the bomb blasts.
The Saudis suffered blowback from the Afghan jihad and from 9/11 in the same way that the Americans did. Remember, the Americans were also actively engaged in the anti-Soviet jihad, providing weapons and training, and they collaborated very closely with the Saudis in the 1980s. This was very much a dually managed collaborative effort between the Al Saud and American political leaders. Of course, the Americans suffered with 9/11. The same was true for the Saudis. Following 9/11, an Al-Qaeda branch in the Arabian Peninsula became active in 2003 and 2004. So the Saudis have both a political interest in confronting terrorism and also see themselves as actively engaged in confronting and containing terrorism. And I think as far as the senior members of the ruling family and the intelligence community go in Saudi Arabia, that's all true. The problem is that politically and ideologically, there are also quite a few people in Saudi Arabia, both in the government and outside of it, who see themselves as having interests that are closer to global terrorism than it is to their own government or to the United States.
The U.S. Secretary of State has named Saudi Arabia as the world's most significant source of funds for Sunni terrorists. Hillary Clinton.
Last December, a diplomatic cable from the U.S. Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, was sent to embassies in Middle East countries, which are the key sources of money for militants. Saudi Arabia tops the list.
Donors in Saudi Arabia constitute the most significant source of funding to Sunni terrorist groups worldwide,
she wrote in the cable.
It's been an ongoing challenge to persuade Saudi officials to treat terrorist financing emanating from Saudi Arabia as a strategic priority.
The trend one notices in Saudi Arabia is that they are much against jihadi organisations if they threaten the security of the House of Saud, or if jihadis begin to act within Saudi Arabia. But they are quite prepared to use jihadis as an instrument of Saudi foreign policy and Saudi influence abroad. Therefore, up to last year, there was a steady flow of Saudi volunteers going to fight for ISIS, the Islamic State, or other groups in Syria and in Iraq. It's only more recently that the government has attempted to clamp down on that. You had Saudi preachers, immensely influential, often speaking on satellite television stations financed by Saudi royals, preaching hate to Shia, preaching jihad in Syria and elsewhere. So there's always been an ambivalence in Saudi policy between what they want to see at home and what they want to see abroad.
There are dangerous signs that Syria's civil war is spreading outside its borders. Shiite Iran actively supports the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad against Sunni Muslim rebels who are backed and armed by Sunni powers Saudi Arabia and Qatar.
You've got a massive disaster unfolding in Syria, fueled by this regional superpower tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
The Saudis see Syria as a piece on a broader regional chessboard. Syria is important because it's a powerful Arab state, plays an important role in the Arab-Israeli conflict and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. But more generally, it also plays a role in how Saudi Arabia views the balance of power across the region. Because the Assad regime and because Syria historically has been under the influence of Tehran, the regime in Iran, Saudi Arabia views it as a vital piece to potentially check and roll back to do damage to Iranian interests in the region. Their principal concern, aside from profiting and enjoying privilege from the sale of oil, is to make sure that Iran doesn't become a counterpart, a serious rival for hegemony in the region, and it views Syria through that lens.
Saudi Arabia accuses Iran of destabilizing the region because it interferes in the local Arab scene. And at the same time, Saudi Arabia itself does exactly that because it does interfere in Egypt. We have seen how Saudi Arabia cheered the coup in Egypt that took place in July 2013. We see Saudi Arabia also supporting the Syrian rebels, whereby Iran supports the regime. And therefore, there is a sort of undeclared war between Saudi Arabia and Iran that is taking place in the Arab world. Saudi Arabia worries about Iran expanding in the region, expanding its influence. It's already there in Iraq, it is in Syria, it is in Lebanon, and also Saudi Arabia worries about any kind of connection between Iran and Yemen through the Houthis, who are also Shia. And therefore, Saudi Arabia feels that it is encircled by Shia-backed Iranian influence. And it is competition over leadership.
Of course, Saudi hostility to Shiism, which was always there historically, was also increased by the Iranian Revolution of 1979, when the Shah was overthrown. And the Saudis have always felt threatened by the government of Iran and by the Shia in general. So it sees successive crises in the Middle East as, among other things, a conflict between itself and Iran and between the Sunni and the Shia.
So how much support has the Saudi government given jihadists in Syria?
We know, for example, that the former chief of intelligence, Bandar, a former ambassador to the United States, had favorites on the ground. It's very likely that he supported them with both material and with financial support. This is an important question, and it's one that's difficult for a lot of people to understand, I think for this reason. When we talk about power and states, especially in the oil-rich parts of the Arab world, and really the global south more generally, we're not talking about formal state policy necessarily being the most important thing. Because wealth is widespread, because money and patronage trickles and gets distributed in complicated ways, it's just as likely that somebody in a small corner in an office in the Interior Ministry or in the Foreign Ministry in Saudi Arabia, or even a business person of some note with attachments to the regime, might see themselves as having an influential role in the outcome or in moving money around or materiel, if you will. Even if it's not official policy, or if the royal family is not directly involved, it doesn't mean that some sector of the state is not involved. The opposite is also true. If some aspect or element or part of the Saudi or the Kuwaiti or the Qatari state is involved, it doesn't mean that the royals are necessarily involved either.
First, we will conduct a systematic campaign of airstrikes against these terrorists.
For the first time, the United States and a coalition of Arab nations have launched airstrikes against Islamic State extremists inside Syria.
Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Jordan and Bahrain are reportedly involved.
I don't think the Saudis necessarily saw ISIS or the Islamic State as an existential threat or as a serious problem in the region until it spread to Iraq. So not until it became a regional phenomenon that holds a significant amount of territory and from which it might ostensibly target the Saudis or other Saudi partners in the region, the Jordanians, for example. But it's simultaneously true that while the Saudis have come to be anxious about ISIS's potential role in the region, even so far as coordinating or at least cooperating with Iran on or military operations against it in Iraq, that it also shared a criticism, a fundamental complaint that ISIS expressed and the way that ISIS built a base of support in Iraq, and that is that the old Maliki regime, former prime minister from the Shia community with whom Saudi Arabia had no relationship, was seen as a problem in the region. And so the Saudis have traded one problem, Maliki is no longer prime minister, for another one. The problem is, and kind of parsing meaning in all of this, is that the Saudis have backed whatever forces are necessary to challenge the Shiite regime in Baghdad, and ISIS is one of the outcomes of that strategy.
The Western powers, bubble America, had an interest in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf of preserving the status quo, as being opponents of Iran, of Syria, of Libya, of anybody who was deemed hostile to Western actions in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia also was a great sort of arms market. America has or had contracts for about $86 billion worth of aircraft and other defense equipment. The Saudis also were very acute in cultivating powerful people in the West through money, through friendship. So, for instance, they always had a close relationship with the Bush family long before any of the Bushes became president of the US. And it's noticeable how many important people in Washington and other capitals have jobs as consultants to companies doing business in Saudi Arabia or have think tanks which receive Saudi funding. I think they cultivated all means to make sure that they were influential enough to the West to prevent serious criticism.
It's remarkable to me that we're at this moment again, where the Saudis have been complicit in the rise of a jihadist network in Syria, seen it spread regionally, and now becomes at least a regional threat, if not a global threat. The fact that we're not just repeating the sins of 2003, but the same kind of patterns that persisted in the 1980s and that led to the violence of the 1990s and 2001. It's as though nobody learns any lessons or pays close attention to what the structural forces are, that the Saudis, they play this game, they have the support of their Western patrons like the United States to do so. And then ultimately, everybody's put in a position where they have to manage the crisis. I don't see it ending well. And part of the reason I don't see it ending well is we have no evidence that the Saudis think that this isn't something they can continue to do and at least survive in the medium term. But there's also a larger problem here, and that is that nobody seems to be willing to embrace or pursue the kinds of policies and practices that might once and for all eliminate the structural conditions that give rise to networks like ISIS in the first place. The United States and its partners in the region continue to insist that a military solution is the only solution to the problem of terrorism more generally. They refuse to address autocratic politics, imbalances, inequities across the region. It's all just a colossal mess. And until we're willing to think about that very carefully and very critically, it seems to me that the status quo is going to endure for the foreseeable future.
Toby Jones, author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forged Modern Saudi Arabia. My other guests, journalist Patrick Coburn, author of The Jihadist's Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising, and Madawi al-Rashid, author of A History of Saudi Arabia. The sound engineer is Judy Rapley. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN.